Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of Yoga International.
And I'm Kyle Rebar, the AV...
Director?
No, sure.
And today, Kyle and I are joined once again by Jessica Stickler. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
You may know Jessica from our website. She has a lot of great videos, classes, and tutorials that you can check out by typing Jessica Stickler into the search bar. You might also know her from her podcast, which you can find on iTunes or at yogastickler.com. And Jessica has joined us in the past here on Yoga Talk. I believe the title of that one, I don't remember the number, but I think it was Learn About Jiva Mukti Yoga with Jessica and Luis, ! So Jessica, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are if they are just tuning into the podcast, and what it is you do, what you're excited about?
I'm still trying to find out who I am, but in the yoga sense, I've been teaching Jiva Mukti Yoga in New York and internationally for about 9 years, and practicing only just a hair longer than that. And yeah, that's about all I have to say for myself.
Well, welcome back to the podcast. And if you guys want to learn a lot more about Jessica's full yoga story and what Jiva Mukti is, then we'll link to our first podcast with her in the show notes. But I wanted to start off right today, Jessica, with a question that you and I were actually kind of talking about yesterday. And it's something that I've been kind of pondering and contemplating a lot lately, too. And my question is, you teach a lot of yoga on the internet, as do I, and we Yoga International are the internet, and the internet is forever. When we put our classes out there online, they represent who we were and the best that we knew at the time that we made them. But as teachers, yogis, and humans, we're constantly changing and growing, and I'm wondering if you could speak to some of the challenges surrounding this.
Yeah, I pretty much have a love-hate relationship with the internet. I think one of the things that I've learned about teaching because I have the podcast is, you know, I had to get very used to putting myself out there in a way that feels permanent. I have classes up on the internet from when I was a beginner teacher and, you know, from 7, 8 years ago. And I had to get used to the idea that no class could be perfect, that there was always going to be something to improve on. And I had to get used to the idea that, you know, whatever we say in class, whether it's on the internet or not, even if it's a live class, whatever we say in the moment, that's sort of the best that we know. You know, we can only say what we know up to that point. And so there's versions of myself up there that I'm sure I'm saying something that now I would disagree with, or I have a more refined understanding of, or, you know, it's changed or it's more complex. And you sort of have to like live in that space of knowing that those versions are out there, but still be growing and evolving and changing your teaching practice.
Yeah, that's a really good attitude to have too, because I feel like as soon as I write something or like and it publishes, I'm like, oh, I wish I didn't do that. I would do this differently, you know. I think there was one article in particular where I wrote about side plank, and I immediately changed my mind on a particular alignment instruction once I learned a little more. And I thought, oh, I wish that I could write this article over. I wish I could do it again. I don't think that anymore. And then I got a little more information and actually went back to my previous opinion, but with a little more knowledge. And I thought, well, okay, now it's okay now. And it's just like a reminder, I guess, of that constant, you know, our understanding is shifting and changing.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think that's important for students. As a yoga student, I think it's important to know that, you know, what your teacher is saying isn't like absolute truth. It's like this process and this evolution that we're all going through together, and that each of the instructions can be a sort of refinement rather than a big pendulum swing to one direction. You give an instruction and it doesn't mean go all the way the heck to the other side of that instruction. It means like, okay, what if we go a little bit further this way, or what if we swing back a little further this way? And it's a bit of a more subtle process than I think we sometimes
yes
feel.
Well, I like and what then, you said yeah. yesterday when we were talking. You said, you know, usually the right answer is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, and it's been a big lesson for me too as a teacher of just not, like, because it's a process and because it's an evolution, it's actually helped me keep from getting too dogmatic about what it is that I think that I know at any given time. And I think that's helpful as teachers, that we don't sort of dig our heels in so hard with what it is that we think that we know, that then we block ourselves from further understanding or from growing our understanding, and sort of always leaving that spaciousness or that sort of ability to be open to the possibility for more complexity or find understanding or, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. So let's shift gears a little bit
yes.
from
so,
internet classes to...
I hear you teach or you run a killer live music class. And as someone who is a musician, I play in a band. The first yoga class I went to was a live music class.
Oh, cool.
And they're still my favorite classes to go to. How did you put this thing together and what goes into running a live music class?
More than you'd think. so actually, you know, how it all started, I was actually offered a class time that was late at night on a Friday, and actually other people turned the class time down. Like it seemed like actually other people didn't even want the class time. And it's true, I did start teaching. I was a brand new teacher. I started teaching late at night on Fridays, and after a few weeks I had like, you know, one student, two students, a couple of students, and I was like, I gotta make this something special. I gotta make this like a thing, you know? And, you know, music and sound is a very important part of the Jivamukti method. So Sharon and David always emphasize music in the classroom, and we do a lot of spiritual practice around nada yoga or deep inner listening. And so I thought, what a great way to sort of bring those practices of, you know, music and of nada yoga into the classroom environment and make it an actual real experience for people and blend the yoga and the music together. So it started just with like me and this sitar player and this cellist that I knew. And it would sort of just be like one of the two of them on Friday nights. And as it got to be more of a thing, then more musicians started actually approaching me. And nowadays, more often than not, people will write me. I had this fabulous kirtan duo named Ito and Joe from Australia. They're amazing. You should check them out. And they emailed me from Australia and were like, we're going to be in New York and we heard about your class. Can we play? And I'm just like,
whoa.
I couldn't believe my luck. Like with everything I had, you know, built and created that had sort of come to a place where people are coming to me and where there's this like beautiful just exchange. I get to meet so many amazing people and I get to bring so many amazing musicians into the classroom. It's really a fun time.
Hmm. What kind of styles do you like? Do you have in your classes? Do you do mostly like kirtans and stuff, or do you do more?
So I like stuff? I love experiencing the way that different music feels in practice. And to be perfectly honest, when I'm alone in my room, I actually really like practicing to heavy metal.
Yes!
That's awesome.
And there's something about the sort of energy of metal that is really exhilarating to me and really, you know, helps me kind of like focus and get into a particular kind of zone. And while I haven't actually had any heavy metal musicians come in for Friday night class, I do like to experiment with different experiences. So I've had, you know, a great cellist has come in. I've had people come in and play the hammered dulcimer, which is, it's almost like a harp that lays on its side and you play it with these little hammers. I've had basically full kirtan bands come in. I've had classical music. I've had jazz. I've had, actually, most recently, a guy who practices regularly in class and sort of is quiet about his own talents. He several years ago won the like world championship for beatboxing.
Whoa.
And so he beatboxed through the whole class. And when he started, so I introduce him, I'm like, this is Tiago. And there's like no instruments around him. I'm like, welcome to live music. This is Tiago. And everyone's like, huh? And then we start moving. And I kid you not, even I had to look over to be like, did he like carry a small cymbal in with him that I didn't see come into the room or something? Because even I couldn't believe the like sounds he was able to produce. And so that was a particularly like wild and fun and mind-blowing recent class.
When I practice alone, I practice to jazz a lot.
Oh,
and
cool.
As soon as you said jazz, like my face just lit up, and I would love to incorporate jazz in yoga class. That sounds like a fabulous
idea. It's really
idea.
Fun.
Yeah.
So how do you dig up musicians, or how, you said you started with two people you knew, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've found people in various ways. A lot of times people will come take a class and then after class, they'll be like, that was really enjoyable. And also I'm a traditionally trained, you know, Spanish vocalist and can I come in? And, you know, and it's sort of like, it's sort of just now kind of feeds on itself and different collaborations have sort of just grown out of its very existence, which has been really fun. I also found one of my favorite musicians who comes back regularly is a musician who plays the kora, which is a traditional Western African instrument. And I actually found him in the subway, and I don't usually solicit subway musicians for yoga class, but I particularly love the kora. It's a really beautiful instrument, and I love the sound of it. And there are several kora musicians playing around the subway, but I could hear him from like across the platform, and I just was really drawn to his particular style of playing. It was very clean and very melodic, and like it just was really moving. So I did approach him, and I kind of slipped a business card in his hat, and I was like, "Hey, call me, come play for yoga class, please." And he's been coming ever since, and that's a really cool instrument to practice to. There's some way in which that instrument resonates, which feels really good in the body. And the songs are spiritual songs that are about gods and kings. And it's passed down to every generation. So you're not a musician. Like your father passes the songs on to you and you play them, and your father passes the songs on to the son. And so everyone plays the songs, and they're all these, you know, sort of uplifting myths about, you know, heroes and gods and stuff. So yeah, so it's got this like really kind of beautiful lineage to it. And it's got this very cool, like familial lineage to it. And I like the idea that we are all musicians. We can all sing. We can all dance. It's not something that's exclusive to celebrity singers and dancers. Yeah.
That's one thing. No, I haven't practiced a ton of Jivamukti yoga, but one thing that I've kind of noticed, and maybe you can tell me if this is an accurate perception or not, but it seems like in some ways it's very adaptable. Like obviously it is in a lot of ways a traditional practice, and then there's the spiritual thread woven throughout, and you practice pranayama and meditation. It's not, you know, like solely asana or anything like that, but yet you can have all different musicians come into the classroom, or you can take new aspects of yoga that are kind of being developed and weave that into a class, and it seems like it's welcomed.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that is so attractive to me about Jivamukti, and one of the things that's so fun about it, is that there is actually a lot of structure. There's like just enough structure that it gives you the parameters to actually have creativity within the scope of the parameters. And I think that's, you know, I think good art and good creativity come from having parameters in some sense. I sometimes joke, you know, it's like, what if you had no sort of rules and no structure and you just, everyone gathered together in a room and I just said, like, hey, y'all, just move however you want for the next 90 minutes. Like, it would be kind of...
Been in a yoga class like that. Maybe not not 90 minutes, but like, you know, when you go to yoga class and you're like, oh, I'm going to be led. This is going to be so great. And all of a sudden the teacher's like, okay, let's dance around for this, this 10 minutes here, and not being a freestyler, I'm like frozen. Like, what do I do?
Sure. Yeah. And those explorations can be really transformative really like wonderful. But I just, you know, there's something about structure. There's something about moving within structure that sort of gives rise to that self-examination or that self-understanding that we're looking for in the yoga practice. Whereas sort of without the rules or without the structure, it's harder to look inside and look at the mind and look at the tendencies.
Absolutely. I think that's kind of... almost like the point, for lack of a better word, of yoga in general. Like if you look to the sutras, there's the systematic approach so that we have, like you said, a boundary in which we can get to know ourselves better.
Yeah, and whatever those boundaries are, if they're, you know, sitting still in a meditation and focusing on a particular thing, or whether they're moving through a particular sequence of physical movements, or whether they're, you know, chanting a certain mantra a certain number of times, like we have all these ways in which we sort of give our minds and our bodies and our emotions parameters so that we can kind of see what turns up.
So I've noticed a lot of teachers these days, and I feel so like curmudgeonly when I say this, all these kids these days. But
I've been feeling a lot that way lately. I feel very curmudgeonly.
Should change the name of the podcast to Yoga Curmudgeons.
Yoga Curmudgeons.
A lot of teachers these days tend to take an eclectic approach toward training, dabbling in various styles without committing to one specifically. And I wanted to ask you, as a teacher who does teach in a specific style, what are the benefits as well as the challenges of sticking to one particular type of yoga?
Yeah, I mean, that really does go back to that question of like having structure and having creativity and having that balance. I do see sometimes it can be difficult to sort of dabble in a bunch of different styles and still hold the center, like still hold a perspective or a point of view or like a place of standing, right? And I had a pretty, maybe a unique path in that regard, in that I took a Jivamukti class. It was like my first yoga class ever. But I just loved it. I mean, I remember the teacher was Matthew Lombardo. I remember the teacher was like playing all this cool music and I was like, this is rad. And I remember my first assist in that class. And I have a reputation for not being a very touchy-feely person. And in the yoga world, that sometimes gets me in trouble. But I remember that first hands-on assist. And I remember feeling like this real power and potency to like having a bodily physical adjustment that wasn't laden with, you know, sexual tension, that wasn't laden with parental tension, it wasn't laden with friend expectations, it wasn't laden with all of these like sort of loaded emotional things that we usually like experience touch. Having. Yeah. And that completely blew my mind to the point where I still remember it. Like it was seated spinal twist and I like remember the assist. So anyway, that class led to me just being like, oh, I'm going to like just keep taking these classes because this is so cool. And I took pretty much only Jivamukti classes until I decided to go to training. And then even after I went to training, you know, I've maybe done like one Bikram class and like an Ashtanga class and an Iyengar class, but I really have immersed myself quite deeply in the method. And now, because I've sort of immersed myself so deeply both in practice and in teaching it, I feel like I can better sort of reach out and take an inspiration from another teacher or from another method and see how it like fits or doesn't fit within the scope of my model of practice without sort of sacrificing the center, sort of sacrificing the core or the foundation.
That's really good. That sounds so empowering.
Yeah, it's cool. It's been a really interesting year. This is kind of the first year where I'm like, whoa, I've been doing this longer than I've been doing any other thing in my life. Like now you sort of start to inch towards that 10-year mark and you go, oh, like I'm not a beginner at this anymore.
I liked what you said, going back a little bit about the Jivamukti assist too, because one thing that, and again, I don't have a ton of experience in that style, but one thing that I've noticed when I've taken classes a couple of times is that I feel like a lot of times in yoga class, especially when I was more of a beginner and I was more at that time, whenever a teacher would come up to me and they were going to give me an assist, I would always get this jolt of like, oh, I'm doing something wrong. They're fixing something that I'm doing wrong. And because in the Jivamukti class that I took, the assists were so prevalent, like in Sun Salutes, and I can link to those videos, listener, if you're curious what we're talking about. I felt like I wasn't being fixed, but just that the teacher was giving me a deeper experience. That was good.
Yeah. And sometimes it's useful to clarify that to people who haven't been to a Jivamukti class or people who are coming to the beginner classes. It's sometimes helpful to clarify that it's not like your math teacher coming over. It's not corrective,
yeah.
Right? But we've all grown up in a similar system of education and a similar, you know, familial model. And so we sort of have that feeling of like, oh, if the teacher's coming my way, I'm wrong. And it's nice to be able to let go of that. It's nice to realize that, oh, actually, there's a broad variety of assists that aren't corrective. There just might be the teacher sees that you could actually move into a new space, or there's like a little more space to work with, or you could, you know, and just to give you a different sort of energetic experience of the pose rather than like I'm correcting your alignment.
Yeah.
The first time I had ever seen anything Jivamukti related was when you guys first came to the Himalayan Institute to film a few years ago. And that was, you know, before I started practicing. I'm still a painful novice, but I remember filming the class and thinking, whoa, like watching this is like the way the assists were executed. It was very beautiful to watch, very artful. It was almost like a dance.
Yeah, that's really cool. What it feels like when it's going well. I mean, when, you know, when you're sort of in the flow and, you know, you can sort of choreograph your assists to support the student's movement, it does start to feel more like a dance, more integrated than just like, you know, moving body parts around.
So Jessica, is there a particular pose or aspect of anatomy or alignment that you're totally geeking out on these days? Like, what are you excited about?
Always and everything. oh, gosh.
The third metaphalangeal joint on the left hand.
So, actually, that does remind me. Okay, there's a couple of things we could geek out about. So I'm geeking out. I mean, if you want like a specific muscle, right? So in your in your fingers, you have muscles. They're called lumbricals. And rather than, so you can bend at your, if you look at your hand, so listeners, hold your hand up in front of you.
We're all looking at our hands.
You can bend your pointer finger at the first knuckle. You might have to hold the other knuckles in place to get that first bend because we're not used to sort of moving that on its own. So you can just wiggle that one forward like a little red rum action, right? And then that's The Shining for those of you younger listeners out there. Go watch it. That's your homework. Okay. So then you can also bend the second knuckle. And you can bend them both together, kind of curling them in as like an earthworm sort of. So now both knuckles are bending, yeah? You have this very specific muscle that bends the second knuckle but keeps the first knuckle straight. So you have to have a muscle that attaches that attaches in such a way that flexes that first knuckle but extends the second knuckle. That little muscle is called a lumbricle, and that's its job. And that is kind of like the weirdest little anatomical thing that I'm like spooking out about. It's not very, there's not like a pose that I'd be like, engage your lumbricals now. But it's kind of an interesting and fascinating thing about the body is that there's so many movements and so many strategies for movement. And we take things for granted so much. And then I'm also geeking out just about the concept of stretch lately. And actually, it turns out that stretching a muscle and contraction of muscles are actually this super mysterious thing that from a completely molecular standpoint are kind of a mystery. Like even doctors are like, well, this is like what we think is happening, but we're not like sure, you know, science. and you know, stretch is actually like a warning signal from your muscles to your nervous system. So it's made me think a lot about, you know, when we sort of go to the end range of our movement, because there's something pleasurable about feeling that sensation of stretch. And not to take away from the pleasure of feeling stretch, if you want to go there, by all means go there. I love the sensation of stretch, so I love getting into that place. But it might not be strategically like the most optimal way to lengthen the muscles. In fact, when you start to lengthen a muscle and you feel that sensation of stretch, it's actually the muscles going, whoa, stop, don't go any further, danger, danger, Will Robinson. And so in theory, it sort of stops at that point, and it doesn't, it resists lengthening any further because it feels like it's in danger. Whereas if we want to sort of lengthen the muscle, a better strategy is to sort of not go to that end range point and to sort of not go to that experience. But all of our language revolves around stretching and feeling the stretch and feeling the this and feeling that. And so then the question becomes like, how do you teach poses if that's not the sort of baseline for experience?
Yeah. And then when those questions come up too, like, well, I'm not feeling the stretch, I'm not feeling anything. And, you know, you want to say that's okay, but.
Right. And yeah. How do we make all of the in-between experiences positive and good and reinforce the in-between experiences and not just privilege stretch over all of the other possibilities? And what's even the language for that? We don't even have a word for feel your legs really not stretching.
But not completely contracting either. And yeah. You know,
how do you even sort of express those types of movement experience? And can we make room for those types of experience of movement without having to go to the extreme of everything? And I think especially in this culture, and especially because of the sort of overlap between yoga and fitness culture, I think there's a tendency to want to go to end range of everything whenever possible. Yeah. And that's maybe not strategically the best way to move muscles and bones around.
Yeah, well, even when I went to
sorry, was that boring?
Oh,
I can
no,
sometimes like
no.
geek out on stuff
that
that's
was
like
awesome.
That like people are like
I'm going to be playing with my index finger all day now. So
A-side, I feel like your explanation of those weird finger muscles would make a fantastic 1 minute anatomy animation video.
Yeah.
If I could steal your soundbite.
Yeah. Oh, totally. That would be awesome.
We should
wait,
also,
are you, what, you're animating things. You got to animate things for me. I have like a million ideas bursting. This brain is bursting with ideas, but I have no animation skills.
Huh. Oh, yeah, he's got animation skills.
I know a thing or two about animation.
Oh man, we
really
have to
good
talk.
Animation skills. I have a question that I'm asking only just because like you're sitting right here and I can ask you because I finally have a chance. After yesterday, so we did a photo shoot yesterday and Jessica was kind enough to model for an article that I wrote, which we'll link to in the show notes so you can see her amazing asana practice. And we also got some beautiful photos of her doing like forearm stand and headstand. And I stood there watching in awe as you went into lotus from headstand. And I know that's always like for me, doing any sort of lotus in an inversion beyond half lotus has always felt like a really hard thing to do. Like usually that's the one thing in yoga practice I would say right now that I can't seem to like figure out. Do you have any tips for getting the, because I can do lotus on the ground, I can do forearm stand, headstand, but combining the two seems a little out of reach.
So,
not to put you on the spot.
So let's see. I'm trying to think about what I did in my practice. One thing is hanging out upside down in Baddha Konasana with your soles of the feet together and your knees apart. And actually, there's something about being upside down that actually you can actually get the hips to really be quite cooperative and do their like open hip thing when you're in an inversion. So hang out in Baddha Konasana upside down a lot, and then when you're ready to transition, just hang out in half lotus upside down a lot. So just bring one ankle as close to the opposite hip as you can get into, hang out there, and also push your foot into your opposite leg. So you're actually kind of trying to help the extended leg hip extend a little bit, if that can even make sense in a podcast.
Like a little bit of a hip flexor. Mini lengthening.
Yep, like that.
cool. I will try that.
Okay,
thank you.
Cool.
Thank you for those
try
tips.
Both legs.
Yes, definitely. And perhaps listeners who might be having similar frustrations will be helped by that too. Thank you. So finally, before we wrap up today, do you have any projects that you're working on or any upcoming events that you'd like listeners to know about?
Yes. Well, you named already like two of my big projects that pretty much take all of my time and energy. One is the podcast. I record and post one of my live classes every month and put it up on iTunes. And then two is my live music classes in New York City, which happen every single Friday night at 6:45. And then this coming Thanksgiving weekend, I will be teaching alongside with Matthew Lombardo, my first Jiva Mukti teacher ever, and now we're co-teaching together. That's cool. So Thanksgiving weekend, Jiva Mukti has been doing a retreat basically for 20-plus years up at Ananda Ashram, which is in Monroe, New York. And we do a really cool program. It's not just asana class here and there and a break in between. There's Sanskrit classes, there's meditations, there's evening programs at the ashram. So it's quite a like full and rich program, and I'm really happy to be a part of it this year. So that's on Thanksgiving weekend. You can find more information soon on the Jiva Mukti website or on my website, but it's not officially posted yet.
So just to clarify now, for someone who's listening and who may be dropping by New York, where physically in space can we find your live music class in New York?
Well, just after Venus and before Mars. No, just if you're in New York, we're right in Union Square. We're at 851 Broadway. So that's on Broadway between 13th and 14th on the second floor.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Jessica.
As always.
Awesome talking to you. And listeners, if you have any questions that you'd like us to pass along, or you have any questions or topic ideas for Yoga Talk, you can send those to where again, Kyle?
yogatalk@yogainternational.com?
That's right, yogatalk@yogainternational.com. And you can also find more podcasts at yogainternational.com. And you can find us on iTunes and Google Play and the podcatcher of your choice. We should be there. We will catch you guys next time.
And the score for this podcast is composed by Austin Joying.